Hey folks, just a quick word of introduction to what follows because it's a little different shape than the usual podcast. This was recorded on Easter Sunday morning, and normally when we gather, the first part of our gathering includes some music, some community time, and then we kind of go to part two, which is the talky bit, which if you follow the podcast, you'd be familiar with. This particular morning, Tim Penner, who together with Jane and their kids often take care of some of the music and community time, leadership, had a short story that he'd written that him and I had talked about earlier in the week, and realized that the two pieces, what he'd written entirely on his own and what I'd written on my own, reflecting on this particular season, really kind of were bookends in some ways and very complementary, different lenses on Easter. And so, as part of the first part of our gathering, Tim and Jane did some music, and Tim also read this short story of his. And then we went to the talky bit. I called the Sunday overall A Tale of Two Women, which doesn't make any sense if you only listen to my reflections on a particular female character from the Easter story. And in addition to not making any sense, you'd be missing an absolute treat if we didn't include Tim's story. So what follows is Tim Penner, a recorded version, not the live version, but a post-live recorded version of his short story, and then the talky bit. Tale of Two Women. Enjoy.
An Easter story. It was not the sort of morning that she was used to, and she felt wholly unprepared to face it. She could sense the morning sunlight seeping through the shutters even before she opened her eyes, swung her legs over the side of the bed, and felt the coldness of the hardwood floors against the hardened pads of her feet. After taking a second to appreciate the feeling, before forgetting it amongst the million sensations she would experience that day, she breathed deeply, allowing the oxygen to permeate the depths of her lungs before exhaling. The silence made that morning unusual. The world was simultaneously remarkably and unremarkably quiet. None of the usual sounds permeated the walls of her bedroom. No cars driving by, no footsteps above her head, no radios bleeding in from the next apartment, no sounds of arguments, no voices of children, no sirens from emergency vehicles careening across the nearby bridge, no early morning songbirds enthusiastically greeting the day. There was only the inky black silence that tends to saturate every space it enters, suffocating sound waves as it rises, slowly, like a rolling tide. It had been that way since he left. Gone without any ceremony or significance, just a few short, strained breaths, aided by a ventilator and a hospital bed on the outskirts of downtown, in that hospital that overlooks the river near where it meets the other river. She knows she shouldn't say he left, that she should use that other word, but she's not ready to use that word yet. D, blank, blank, blank. No, not ready yet. 40 years. 40 out of 63. Now what? Stop asking yourself that, she chided. It's too soon for that. You haven't even put him in the goddamn ground yet. Suzanne, her mother called from the front seat of the car that drove through her memory. Your language. Sorry, she said aloud, ceding to the authority of her mother, who, despite having died 17 years ago, still took up significant psychic real estate in the part of her brain that produces guilt for minor indiscretions, like taking the Lord's name in vain. What an odd phrase that was. The Lord's name in vain. Sunday school speak for swearing. If it's such a bad word, then why did God make it so fun to say? That's the sort of question Suzanne regularly asked herself in the shower or while driving away from some repressive social event. She never dared to utter it in front of people. It's probably the reason for my reputation, she thought to herself as she entered the kitchen and took the bag of coffee beans from the fridge. Her car keys were where she had left them when she came home from the hospital. He had left at 11:05 p.m. on Friday. Other than the doctors and nurses, she was the only person that knew he'd gone. She felt a tinge of conspiratorial pleasure at that thought, as she poured beans into the grinder and turned it on. She knew that soon enough she would have to start making phone calls. The kids, his brothers, her sister, some friends. Suzanne knew that they would all be upset at her for not letting them know sooner, but she was quietly pleased with herself for having held on to the news all day yesterday. She would have told somebody if anyone had called, but no one had. Instead, she spent the day watching television and just let the idea sit there somewhere near the bottom of her stomach, in that space reserved for big news, good or bad. Good news feels different from bad. It has an air of expectation, feels distinctly like possibility. Bad news tends to just sag limply, rolling from side to side as she moves. The weird thing about this feeling was that it did neither, and both. She was sad, absolutely. She cried most of the way home two nights before, her tears causing the lights on the street to blur and streak as she drove. She had been crying for months, really, ever since that afternoon at the doctor's office when the oncologist, who was probably younger than their marriage, pronounced his diagnosis. He had been right, almost to the day. Now that it was over, she seemed to be out of tears. No, that's too poetic. No one runs out of tears, nothing that dramatic. If she was honest, she was just not that interested in crying. She wanted to think about other things. Not illness, not appointments, not performing her grief at church. Is today Sunday, she thought. She looked at the calendar on the fridge and saw the word Easter printed at the bottom of the square, just under the number 17. God damn, she said aloud, followed immediately by a whoops. She felt its wrongness, but also that it felt good. I'm not doing that today, she thought as she filled the carafe in the sink. It's too soon to face that lot. Suzanne hadn't actually been to church in 3 weeks, even though she had told Leonard, that is his name, was his name, that she had been. The truth was that she had spent the last three Sunday mornings a lot like the way she was spending this one, at home in her nightgown until late in the morning. Then she would put on whatever she might have worn to church and went to the hospital just after lunch. There would be entirely too many questions if she showed up this morning, not to mention the fact that her news would be such a downer for an Easter morning. He is risen, they would all say. Who, Leonard? She'd reply. Not yet. She nearly spilled the coffee grinds as she was scooping when she thought about those old faces reacting to her glib retort. Goddamn, that would be funny. Maybe I should go, she thought, ruin all their days. It wouldn't be all that different than the hundreds of Sundays filled with microaggressions and macro humiliations. How could feigned sorrow from women more concerned about the hams in their ovens be worse than the strained facial acrobatics of the Sunday school supervisor when she suggested that Suzanne step back from teaching the second graders? She had been teaching that class for 15 years, but that ended when word got out that their oldest son was cohabitating, their word, with his girlfriend. Or when, during a particularly heated conversation at the youth pastor's house, she silenced the room by suggesting that maybe, just maybe, human sexuality was more than a choice. Leonard was pissed on the drive home that night. Goddamn. Susan leaned back on the counter after pressing the brew button and considered the dust motes. It wasn't Leonard's fault, really. For whatever reason, he needed that place. Needed to go there, needed to see people, needed to be seen. Needed to be seen by God. She had checked out years earlier, but he needed her, and so she went. Now he doesn't need anything, except a funeral. I guess I can go to church for that, she conceded. But not today. I've gone enough, done enough, and heard enough. She opened the fridge to return the coffee beans and find the half-empty container of cottage cheese. She squinted to read the expiry date as her mind wandered around the word. Expiry. To expire, she thought. No, she paused. Don't need to say it yet. She began to think more about Leonard. What would he do? What would he say? If it were me that left, she considered, he would go this morning. First dollop of cottage cheese landed in the bowl as the spoon went back for another. He would have made sure everyone knew already that the prayer chains had started. But that's just because he would want all the sympathy when he showed up. Hugs and teary eyes and special attention from the ladies' auxiliary group. Susan was standing at the sink, rinsing out the container before she stopped to realize what she was saying. She questioned the origins of her indignation as she tried to slow down the breaths that had become short and strained. There was something about the image of Leonard carrying on in her absence that deeply upset her. She believed that he would morph into a different person when she was gone. She had no reason to expect this. He was a good man, attentive, caring, generous with both their kids and her. He had his faults, like everyone else, but Suzanne couldn't say she bore any great resentment against him. Yet she felt something akin to anger, but not quite that. She felt it the night he left, but buried it deep. Here it was again in the form of a constructed fantasy of who Leonard would be in her absence. It felt good to be angry at that version of Leonard, and so she let her mind wander further. She pictured him in a well-appointed living room drinking coffee with another widow on a Sunday afternoon, the two of them negotiating the parameters of a late-in-life love affair. She hoped this would stir up more anger, anger designed to replace the confused feeling she had, which had more tinges of relief than she was ready yet to acknowledge. The more she considered the moment, the more the anger ebbed away. She grasped at the angers, but she couldn't hold on. Instead, she found herself feeling happy for him. She was relieved that he wouldn't live out his final years alone. She even thought of things he could do or say to make himself more appealing. She'd wished she'd taught him how to do more household chores so that this new woman wouldn't realize just how helpless he was. The coffee finished brewing and she poured herself a cup before she took a seat at the table and tried to change course. She pictured Leonard in the church again, sitting by himself in their regular pew. She was sad to see him alone, but retained none of the caregiving response she'd felt for him just seconds before. Something about him being in that space made her less generous. She switched gears again and began to picture herself in the church, in their pew, all alone. But it didn't work. She couldn't picture herself. Not there. It was as if that space, with its extensive woodwork and ornate decoration, was only a place for Leonard, not her. There were more people, pastors, deacons, other members, but for some reason in Suzanne's mind, they all existed to be in service to his presence, not hers. So, while she could imagine accompanying him there, being by his side in their pew, she felt that she too was simply there in service to him. If he ceased to be there, then it ceased to be a place that she could go. Letting her mind wander, Suzanne left the church. She thought about their first house and the living room he had crowded with books. Leonard was sitting on the couch, the newspaper was sprawled across every surface, and he was genuinely surprised when she asked him to move a section or two so she could sit down. Suzanne pictured the room without him. She found herself able to stay there. Next, she thought about Paris, the day they spent navigating the labyrinthine streets looking for the Du Margot Café. The drinks were overpriced, but they paid for the atmosphere. In her imagination, Leonard got up and walked away, made his way down the Boulevard Saint-Germain, and never returned. But she stayed. She could stay there. Her last stop was the downtown parkade, located exactly halfway between their two offices. It was the spot they said goodbye every morning and reunited every evening. It was the location of thousands of kisses, mostly affectionate, but occasionally passionate. If there was one spot she would not be able to imagine herself without Leonard, it was that dusty parking lot. And yet there she was, alone, taking her place in the driver's seat and pulling away. Her breakfast finished, Suzanne returned to the sink to rinse off her dishes before what? She didn't know. Before phone calls? Before dressing? Before Leonard? Before church? Suzanne pictured the sanctuary again. Leonard wasn't there, neither was she. There were others, but not them. There it was again, that sense of relief. But it was no longer masquerading as anger, and so it was easier to identify now. She didn't have to go because Leonard wasn't there. He would never be there again. There were lots of other places he could be, and she could be there too. But if he wasn't there, she would be okay. She knew that there were other places, new places, and that it would hurt a little when he wasn't there to discover them with her, but that his absence would allow her to make them her own. She noticed the sounds returning. One by one, she heard the fights, the engines, the muffled melodies, the shouts of discovery as the kids next door found hidden chocolate eggs. These were all the banal, chunky, and shimmering noises that reminded her that she was alive, and so was everyone else. She wasn't feeling happy, necessarily, but she couldn't say that she was sad, either. She'd loved her life with Leonard, but she felt a new life beginning to formulate, one that would be her own, where she would take the best parts of Leonard with her and formulate new memories, experiences, and ideas that would belong only to her. Suzanne flipped the switch for the bathroom light, opened the hot water faucet, and took a long look at her face in the mirror. It was 40 years older than the last time she had been alone, but, goddammit, it was hers.
Hey folks, welcome to today's Talky Bit. It's good to be with you. Sometimes when I'm planning talky bits, there's a bigger arc to what I'm exploring. Sometimes it's deliberate, sometimes it's even a series. I was talking with someone that's part of our online community earlier this week, and I made some kind of observation about how long that I Doubt It series had gone on. And they said it could still be going on, and they'd be happy about it as far as they were concerned, because it had really resonated for them. I know that's not the same for everybody, of course, but sometimes those longer explorations around a theme can be sustained because the ideas deliberately build on top of one another. They're sequential, and that series was very much like that. Often as not, the talky bits are sort of a collection of one-offs. There's no apparent connection or relationship between them. And what I find interesting is when a bunch of those one-offs seem to have common threads. Now, maybe that's not a surprise in the sense that they're all sort of coming out of my own limited perspectives and inputs, so there's bound to be overlap to the degree that I'm taking care of them. But sometimes I surprise myself in the sense that I look back over a few weeks of explorations and realize just how much they had in common. One of my songwriting friends says that sometimes you look back at an old song and realize you wrote more than you knew. And sometimes I have those experiences too, and that they're encouraging ones for me. I had that experience as I was preparing for today. I was thinking back over the past few weeks, and I realized that if I'd been trying to theme those weeks, if I had been trying to deliberately tie them together thematically, the central idea might have been something like surprise. And when I first wrote that word in my notes, I wrote it in all caps with an exclamation mark, and then I realized when I did that internally, I pronounced it like in a way that was almost exclusively playful. Surprise! Like, boo! And then I realized that wasn't quite the emotion. That was part of it, but that didn't have quite enough range for what I was after with surprise. That surprise certainly included that joyful jump out and say, hey, you didn't know I was coming for the weekend and I'm so glad to be home, kind of an aspect to it, a happy surprise, if you will. But it also had other kinds of surprise woven into it. Things like found treasure, which we talked about a few weeks ago, right? This singular identity-altering discovery that we might stumble across in the path of self-exploration, of exploring what we believe. Things like buried stories that turn out to carry wisdom and good news that are uncovered while we were seeking something totally other. In the case of that particular illustration, uncovered while someone was literally digging for fertilizer, which felt to me like an interesting metaphor when I was considering it. Stories that alter our central understandings and ideas, those kinds of things, those kinds of surprises. What those kinds of stories feel to me like they have in common in our context is, among other things, they might keep us exploring. They might give us the courage. They might encourage us to keep exploring, even when we might not necessarily see a clear why or some sort of a clear end goal for our efforts. There are, of course, lots of reasons to explore what we believe. Some of them, I don't think this is unusual, some of them might arise out of relatively negative experiences. I was corresponding this past week with someone that listens to our podcasts, and they were telling me about an experience in their home community that was really making it tough for them to stay on board there. For them, as they expressed it in their email, the podcasts are kind of a safe place, a bit of a lifeline in a stormy time in their in-person context. And so we've continued that correspondence. We're kind of back and forthing about some ideas. We're doing some exploring by email, motivated in part by this tough time in their home setting. Some of us are exploring what we believe because we were taught to examine things before we consume them. And upon doing what we were taught, we realized that some of the religious beliefs that we inherited didn't stand up to scrutiny all that well, or at least they didn't stay believable for us when we did that. And it's almost like, in that instance, it's almost like our own inherited systems equipped us to leave them. By which I'm primarily thinking of the critical thinking aspect of this, because critical thinking skills don't really care what we apply them to. Critical thinking is kind of like shining a flashlight into a basement closet. The light doesn't care about the closet contents. It just sheds light on whatever is in there. And so that might be kind of a happy experience. Oh, that's where that is. I've been looking for that. Or it could just as well be something more along the lines of, I didn't know mold could grow on ski boots. Now what do I do? Not a personal experience, by the way. When we go exploring,
Sometimes it's because we're excited to see what's around the bend, and maybe we've been encouraged to do that since we were little. We talked about that idea recently as well. Maybe we've just done it on our own and we've had some positive reinforcing experience. Maybe we have a meaning-making story about the nature of the world that motivates us and that gives us courage to continue to move out of our comfort zone and to seek other perspectives. For some of us, exploring and learning is something we do because of love. Because someone we know or respect or care for inspires us to do it. Or maybe someone that we feel positively toward is someone who's inclined to go first, an early adopter, a bold explorer. And they go out there and they explore and they read and they think and they talk and muse upon things. And then they keep coming back to tell us about their experiences. And that gives us courage. That encourages us to keep on poking around on our own. On this particular weekend, which is, among other things, the weekend the Christian tradition and chocolate makers all over the world mark as Easter, I think that theme about being surprised learners can show up in some intriguing ways. As we've seen in the talkie bits these past few weeks, and as we may well know from personal experience, sometimes our moments of insight, of change, of learning, sometimes those moments don't come the way we thought they would or from the sources that we were taught to look to. And that's true within the Christian tradition's Easter story as well. That experience exists within that story, and I want to explore that a bit more this morning. So again, as any other time when I choose to do something like this, I realize it can be hard to hear stories afresh. I'll examine that in more detail another time because there's a particular indigenous scholar that has me really musing upon that idea at the moment. But for now, let's take it as a given if we can. I'll do what I can to demonstrate that I believe that's the case. And then you, of course, will decide for yourself. The first thing we need to know about this particular story is the setting. It's not precisely a dark and stormy night, but it is night. And the odds are pretty good it's foggy because in the hills surrounding Jerusalem at this time of the year, nighttime is usually that way until the sun comes and burns it off. The central character in our story is a woman. And she is clearly identified in the ancient stories as someone that had experienced the teaching of Jesus the rabbi to be life-altering. And when we join her in the story, she is walking in the dark of pre-dawn up scrub-covered hillsides with low cliffs that are pocked with natural caves that often get assigned and used as tombs. And she is grieving. She is grieving because she has lost someone dear to her. She has lost someone that has accepted her as an equal, that has treated her with dignity and kindness, and that has been an important part of her healing journey. At this point in the story, I'm already out of my depth because I identify as a white male and my experiences of everything are impacted by that. I was in, as best I can recall, I was in my 20s before I even had an experience that I would identify as feeling like a minority culture or minority skin tone in a wider setting. And I think back on this part of my life now with the realization that in many ways, although I had been raised in a loving home where my parents were very much full partners in both life and business, I had grown up in a religion that was profoundly male-dominated, and that there were ways in which I was more influenced by misogynistic narratives, not to mention racist narratives, than I was aware of. Once I started to become aware of this, I began to be able to see how it was present in ways that were both structural and personal, and that however it was present, it was always not good. In a first century patriarchal society, that a male Jewish teacher would treat women as equals was and is, even at this distance historically, remarkable. And to be clear, that is not a commentary on Jewishness in any particular way. I am neither qualified nor inclined to make such a judgment. However, that age and culture was generally male-dominated, was patriarchal, is not in doubt. And so the exceptional nature of Jesus' behavior in this realm remains noteworthy, even stunning, and in positive ways. And that's been a central part of the story of the relationship between that rabbi and this woman. The woman in our story, as we have it, has shown that she is made of stern stuff. She has just been through what would be, by any measure, a brutal trauma. She has just watched someone that she cares for deeply be tortured to death. I personally know some people who have been tortured. I know a larger number of people who are close to people who have been tortured, even to death. But I cannot imagine the trauma of watching someone you love be tortured to death. How horrific. That's what she's just been through. And not only has she just been through that, but her supportive community, so essential in how trauma enters and resides with us, her supportive community has fled the scene, understandably from my perspective, but she has stayed. This is a story for a character that has not gone the way she wanted it to at all. The murdered person is someone she has poured her own resources into supporting. They are someone that has been part of the course of her life changing for the better. They have been someone that has been, in her experience, a good gift to her. And now, through circumstances over which she has no control, a trauma in itself, that person has been taken from her. Can you imagine? Are we even willing to try to imagine the magnitude of her sadness, the impact of her trauma? Hard to imagine, but perhaps we can get a clue from her behavior, from some of what we know about how she's coping. It seems clear that part of her personal orientation to the world, her personality, the way she arrived on the planet, is about action. She is, as she has been through much of this story, a person inclined to move in the world. And when we come across her in this story, she is moving. She is hiking up the hillside in the pre-dawn murk. She is off to find the burial site of her friend, her mentor, her healer. And she is, as she has been through much of the worst of these moments, as far as we know, alone. Is that even a good decision? Is that a wise choice? It sounds vulnerable to me. Maybe she doesn't feel it as a choice at all. Maybe it's more like a compulsion. Maybe it's more of a thing that she just feels like she has to do. As we have the story, when she finds the burial site, there's no body there. Which, again, is not what she is expecting at all. If the first place the preferred story went off the rails was with political and political religious mechanisms leading to her friend's death by torture at the hands of military oppressors of her people, if that was turn one off the preferred road, this is certainly turn two. This is getting further and further from what she was expecting. She is here at the gravesite to mourn. And for her, as for any human, locating the body is an important ritual, a literal grounding for the journey with grief. I find it curious that in the telling of this story, the tellers often gloss this in their hurry to make a different point, in the retelling of the story. This is a moment of loss upon loss. quite possibly of profound wrestling with a sense of being even more destabilized than she already was by the circumstances, of beginning to wonder what constitutes the real. If I think about the character in the story that Tim shared with us this morning, that sense of disassociation, of something that seeps into your whole world to such a degree that even the sounds around you start to misbehave. What is real? What's going on here? If we want to help our imaginations to enter this moment in the story from a more contemporary point of view, perhaps we can reference what our Indigenous friends and acquaintances tell us about how it's felt over all these years to know that their beloved children are lying in unmarked graves in places that are not being acknowledged, that are being at best neglected or sold as RV parks or paved over. It's grief piled upon grief. It's enough to make you wonder if what you thought you knew is true or not. It takes enormous courage, deep determination and dignity, the power of spirit, the power of love, to do anything but be immobilized in this moment. Which power, it seems, our character has. Her penchant for action bubbles to the fore. She runs back to her friends, the same people that have abandoned her only hours before, to let them know what she's seen. They return together, they verify the story, and then the men rush off again. She stays to mourn. And somewhere, in that moment of dislocation, in that moment of what is going on here, who am I under these circumstances, what is real, what is believable, someone calls her name. It must have been, at least, a bit of a shock. Even under the most benign circumstances, hearing our name called when we don't expect it can make us wonder if maybe someone else with the same name is in the room. I have permission to share this next story, just so you know. I was at the local DynaCare lab, blood lab, this past week, giving a blood sample for my annual medical checkup, and I was just making my way out through this packed waiting room to the exit when I heard a voice call out, "Tim!" Moment of complete dislocation. Whatever else I was thinking about just then, and it was probably something along the lines of, now I finally get to have breakfast because I had to fast before giving this blood sample. Whatever I was thinking about, it did not include hearing someone call me on the way out. But you can't just ignore that, right? I mean, even if it's not conscious, you even if it's a surprise. And so I did kind of this quick scan of the room, and I quickly spotted Shireen and Leah because they were waving to me, and everybody else in the room was pretty much looking like, you know, waiting room zombies. Our visit, I went over. Our visit was brief because, I mean, how much do you really want to say when you're surrounded by 30 strangers who have nothing to do but eavesdrop? But I got to see Leah's funky new spring shoes, so that in itself made it worth the trip. And I'm so glad they called me and connected. But when something like that happens, there's this split second of double take before we either conclude, that's not for me, there's another Tim right behind me, and they're like, hey, you know, or we come to that conclusion, or we make some kind of connection. Something goes, zzz, you know. In the ancient story that we're exploring, I think this moment is a double take. Because although the voice and the timbre and the way her name is said strikes her as familiar, she recognizes it, the face isn't. She's already been looking at the face of this character in the story and seen nothing there that is familiar. And when she does move toward the person that has called her, they respond to her desire for connection by telling her that whatever their relationship was before, it is now different. It's still good, but it's not what it was. This is not a restoration of before. To put it another way, it's not what she was looking for when she showed up at the tomb. It's not what she was expecting. And in some ways, it's uncomfortable because it's known, it's new, it's weird even. But somehow, it's still good. If you are someone that explores what you believe, you may well have had this moment. It's that heard my name when I wasn't expecting it moment, that instance where we feel a connection in a setting where we were not anticipating a connection. It may be a sense of feeling a connection in a setting where we were told no connection is possible. Or if you do feel a connection, you shouldn't. It's not right. It's outside the pale. It's the singular, life-disrupting treasure coming into view, even though it's unsought. It's the story we didn't know existed until we read it, but once we read it, we can't stop thinking about it because it feels like it's somehow about us. It's about our lives. It's about the lives of those we love. It's about what it means to feel alive in this day, in this place, in this age, in this body. We knew something we had was gone, and we didn't really expect there to be a next, but here it is, unfamiliar and surprising, calling out to us. This past week, I heard a poet say, "Grief can break our hearts open to one another." Exploring what we believe almost always includes some loss, some grief, some heartbreak. Today, I want to invite us to consider the possibility that in the midst of that, perhaps even because of that, our hearts can be broken open to one another, to new connections, to new ways of looking at the world and at others that might not be what we were expecting, but can still be the stuff of new beginnings, of new chapters, of new life. Happy Easter, everybody.